Let's start with a question. So what is that one thing that you like and dislike at the same time about working in the decentralized AI space and why?
Yeah, I think the pace of development is like so fast, especially open source AI. Like I'd say actually it's maybe more true in open source AI, and then decentralized AI is almost catching up. But everything moves so fast. It's a ton of fun, right? But then it's also like you really need to like stay on top of things because just what's possible from a research perspective changes like every 3 months or like every month even. So I think there is, I see mostly the good in that, but I think there's also an aspect of like makes it so you kind of always have to be online and like really tracking what's going on.
Yeah, the space is definitely super cutting edge, but it's also extremely fun because of that. I wanted to dial just back a little bit. We always kind of start by this origin story of, you know, how I actually wanted to ask you, how did you get into crypto in the first place?
Yeah, so I first got into traditional currency. So I was really interested in central banks. Like I had a picture of Janet Yellen, chair of the Fed, in my high school bedroom, which is just a very unusual thing for any high schooler to do. I like worked at the Fed in high school, and to me, currency was like central to it all. I was like, whoever controls currency is really controlling the economy. And so very interested in understanding that. And then I got to MIT and I learned about decentralized currencies. There was like the 5-person MIT Bitcoin Club, which was very ideological, kind of like anarchist of like, hey, like, let's take back control of currency. And around that time, Ethereum was kind of just getting off the ground. And so I started mining Ethereum with one of my friends who, we both had like miner rigs set up in our dorm rooms and we would just use the free electricity from the dorms. And then I would actually go get GPUs from the dumpsters that MIT labs would get rid of. That's what I was talking about just before we started the podcast. Like I went back and visited and there were some kids there actually like hunting, scavenging through the hardware, looking for stuff. And they lent me their screwdriver and their wire snippers. So I actually brought a motherboard home just like for sentimental value. But yeah, that's how I got into crypto. I think mining is a really good way to get involved because you're literally running the network, right? And I think in the proof of work days, it was really cool because you didn't need any capital to get started, right? You could just come in, have hardware and like contribute. And then that got me just fascinated in kind of like decentralization and understanding how you can apply that in Vana's context to really like data and AI. The sort of AI path I took came out of some research that I was doing at CSAIL. So I was really interested in econometrics, which is like just ways of modeling data, mostly about humans. And I wanted to push the methods of like what was possible in terms of like measuring things. And so I started looking at machine learning as a way to do this and ended up taking some classes and doing research with Regina Barzilay, who at the time was really this like pioneer in natural language processing and started kind of trying to understand how can you model data. And this was, so doing stuff with vector embeddings and sort of figuring out how to represent data with AI.
Did you cross paths with SBF or Gary Gensler?
I overlapped. Yeah, so Gary Gensler was teaching a class when I was there. I didn't take it because, you know, a lot of the undergrads, I think, kind of like wrote off some of the Sloan MBA grad classes are like, oh, it's not technical enough. Like, we're going to take like these network design, distributed systems classes. I wish I had. He would be a really interesting character to have shaped some of my like worldview. I wonder what he was. I think the course is online, right? I should actually look at it and kind of understand what he was teaching. But I didn't overlap with SBF. Yeah, I was supposed to graduate in 2019. I actually ended up dropping out because I started a company that came out of automating my job as an intern sorting documents and then like went through YC, learned this whole, found like Silicon Valley and was like, this place is amazing. Like you can just build technology and scale it. And so, yeah, I was, maybe I was not there when we might have overlapped, but overlapped with a lot of other like great founders, great people like Jing, the Optimism founder, was in the MIT Bitcoin Club and like shaped a lot of my worldview. David Borick too, who's now starting Glow Protocol, but he founded Saya, was like the first entrepreneur I met when I was a freshman, and I was like, wow, you can like start a company from nothing and just like scale this technology. So very grateful for like MIT's hacker culture and just the number of great people who I got to learn from.
That's incredible. Yeah, your experience and the, you know, the research that you did, the work that you did at Fed, Central Bank, World Bank, and then you know, starting a YC company in machine learning, all of those are like, you know, like perfect brewing ground for you, for Vana, you know, in a way. It's like everything just, you know, came together. But how did this happen? How did Vana as an idea get started? Is it solely by you, or did you have like, you know, roommates, college friends? You know, how did this happen?
Yeah. So Art, my co-founder, was in grad school at Harvard when I was doing my undergrad, and he had cross-registered for a class at the MIT Media Lab that we were taking on kind of deploying emerging technologies into new markets. As part of the YC machine learning startup, like seen how data is so important to AI models. Like for the only thing that basically mattered for better AI models back then, and I think it's true today too, is just getting more data and better data. And so one question that was really top of mind for me is like, how do you get better data for AI models? And how can you use like a decentralized system to enable that? So really early on, what Art and I were doing is having people label data from their phones to basically contribute to AI models and have everyone be able to contribute data that then goes into making AI models smarter and smarter. One of the limitations, though, with data labeling is that it's not necessarily constrained on the supply side. There are actually a lot of people who are down to label data for like $2 an hour. And really what we started to see is that data collection, which is more of taking data out of walled gardens where it exists today, right? So like exporting your Facebook messages, exporting your Gmail, that was really this place where there was a huge bottleneck, right? So Art had worked at Appen, which is one of the largest kind of data collection companies. They sell data to all the big tech companies. And he was seeing that they kept on failing actually on contracts where they will have sold data and then they're like, hey, we just can't find people to collect who are willing to share this. And so I think that's where we saw decentralization really like coming in and being a driving force. But yeah, that's kind of like the origin story of Vana. Honestly, like early on, so that was some of the research we were doing pretty early on. And even like 2 years ago, I think the idea of like owning your data and the AI models it creates, which is something I had written about really early on, these like user-owned AI foundation models, was a very abstract concept for a lot of people. And I think just the past year has been this massive shift where people have realized, one, AI is super powerful, and two, it's trained on all our data. And so that's been really great to see and has brought a lot of growth to the ecosystem.
Totally, yeah. I want to dive into that, you know, the overview and how it works in a second. But first, so basically you were actually already doing labeling, like scale AI stuff back in 18 through the YC company. And then you worked in Cielo, right? Cielo.
Yeah, yeah. Like, so one of the big bottlenecks we ran into for data labeling is payments, right? Where like we actually were cutting deals. So we were going to all the different mobile like telco providers in the Philippines and in Timor-Leste, a small country in Southeast Asia, where we had some labelers and we needed some way to pay them. So we were like cutting these deals of like, hey, like, can we access your mobile money API in order to pay people to label data? And that was the main friction point of like, hey, like this global payments thing is really hard. And that's actually why I think I was really drawn to the problem space that Cielo was going after, right? Of like, how do you allow someone to make peer-to-peer payments from a phone, especially in emerging markets? And so, yeah, that's kind of some of the history.
Got it, got it. And how did Vana, as you know, the product of Vana evolved over time to it is now?
Yeah, so I'd say like basically what it is like the end vision of like some way for users to own their data and collectively own these products they create has been consistent like since the very beginning. And then it's been this question of like, how do you then get adoption, right? Because if you go to someone in even like 2021 and you're like, hey, you should own your data and the value it creates, like that's like too abstract. And it's also kind of ideological. And people generally don't use products for ideological reasons, right? And so we honestly have been through a huge amount of iteration of like, how do you get users and their data in? So an early version of the product, you could interact with it via a sort of data wallet, which would secure your data. And at that time, we thought that data security and data privacy was like a really strong value prop. What we found is like users don't use a product because it's private, right? Like they want to do something. Like what is the thing you couldn't do before? And then they want it to be private as sort of like, okay, that's like some requirement. So early on we had that data wallet and it was mostly consumer AI applications that were connecting to it. So you could have like, you could generate images of you, of your friends, based on your data that's kind of stored securely in Vana. And then the sort of data pooling use case that's emerged through these different data DAOs has really like accelerated this year. The first major example of that was the Reddit data DAO. And now there's like the 23andMe DAO, the Twitter data DAO called Valara. And so I think that that was kind of, this whole process of basically just like, you have the core piece of the stack, which you're like, hey, like we have a peer-to-peer network for people to own their data. Vana itself, it's a layer one that can work with private data, but most people don't need to think about it that way, right? It's just a way to own your data. But early on, like it didn't make sense to expose that whole piece of the stack, right? So actually like building further up, being like, hey, it's a data wallet, right? You don't need to think about the other stuff. And then even, before that too, of like, hey, you don't need to think about any of the crypto stuff. It's just a way to like train an AI model on your data that you fully own. So I think that, there was kind of a lot of iteration and a lot of figuring out what works. I think like a few learnings, I'd say the number one learning we had is just people do not use products for ideological reasons, right? If you want to reach mass adoption, you need to let someone do something that they couldn't do before. That is what we've really seen emerge with these data DAOs as a way for people to bring their data on board. But it's been, it's been a journey. But it's fun, you know, like you're kind of like constantly like in this world that's like iterating and trying to understand, okay, like here's this end view we want where like everyone owns and controls their data in this decentralized system. Like, how do we actually get there? And like what tools and things that people are thinking about today can we use to help like push us down that path?
That's incredible. What would it look like 5 years down the line? Do you envision that you'd be working with all the consumer apps already and you'd have a DAO for each one of them? What would it look like for end users?
Yeah. So for end users, I think what it just really Vana serving as the infrastructure for any personal data, right? And so today, when you use an application, you just kind of take as a given that they need to have your data, right? But if you look at what the legal structure of it is, it's kind of similar to when you put your car in a parking lot. Like the parking lot doesn't own your car, right? In the same way that when you put your data into an application, the application doesn't own your data. And so I think that having more and more users have that awareness, and then also kind of unbundling data from the application. And that's good for two reasons. One is it like gives users back ownership of their data and really introduces data kind of as a new asset class. And two is it allows for all sorts of new applications, right? Like for me, like training AI models, often I'm like, oh, I can't do that because I don't have the data, right? And like even like I used to train models on my Aura Sleep data and I'd be like asking my friends to like give me an Aura API key so I can train models. But in a world where like Vana has mass adoption, like you can just access your dream data sets and you can build these crazy models without like having to, I think often people are like, oh, the only way I can get access to the data is like working at a big tech company, even though they'd rather stay maybe at a startup, maybe in research. So just making that data way more accessible while also aligning the incentives between the users and the people building with that data. In terms of kind of milestones, like one thing we really keep in mind is how do you get to 100 million users who've all contributed data? So you can build, we call it like almost a data treasury. It's kind of like a central bank for data, but it's decentralized and everyone pulls their data there. So you can actually build better AI models than any centralized company can. So I think those are some of the guiding use cases that we keep in mind. I think also, honestly, a lot of the businesses are going to like look so different, right? Because there's a huge economic shift that's coming from AI, right? And that will have largely happened in 5 years. And so the world just that Vana exists in is going to be extremely different. I think that so much value is going to get created from data, and there's really going to be a pretty massive like labor disruption as well. So yeah, having extremely powerful AI models that are built on that Vana data that users own, and then having kind of full data portability, which I see as like one of the early promises of crypto, actually, original promise of like own your data, bring it with you throughout the internet. And so truly delivering on that promise and enabling that innovation to flourish.
And I think you make Diksha very happy. This is the concept that this is the thing that she worked on for a while. This is great. So data is the currency, and data is also the differentiator in the world of AI. And you want to, you know, you want to position yourself squarely in the center in that shift. And how do you, maybe you can walk us through a little bit more about the business model, or, you know, the, maybe there's a token involved, or, you know, you're giving users a stake, right, in the future of AI. So that how would this all gel together?
Yeah. So every data set and data DAO has their own like data set specific token that basically follows this standard for data set specific tokens. It is essentially like this VRC1 standard, which I actually don't think we have in the documentation anywhere, but that will be coming soon. We work really closely with all the data DAOs who are currently building these out, and they all have their own tokenomics specific to their data set, right? Like the LinkedIn data DAO has a tokenomics advisor just thinking about LinkedIn data and how to price it, right? Of like, hey, when a marginal user comes in, how valuable is their data, right? So like Reddit, the way they did it is they take the square root of your Reddit karma, right? 23andMe DAO, they do it as like, hey, everyone's data is equivalent. You're all just getting the same amount. So it sort of depends per data set. And then the Vana native token on the network kind of acts as like a native gas currency. It's also used to elect the top 16 data DAOs. So you're basically staking with a data DAO, and the top 16 earn a share of emissions. So it's some kind of, I'd say, a cross between like Ethereum and BitTensor in terms of the tokenomics. But the important pieces are, yeah, Vana is that native currency. And then you have all these different data set specific tokens that are used to both incentivize collection of the data, but also create value from the data. The other thing I would call out is there are also AI model specific tokens. Right. So like when you train an AI model, you can basically have this AI model specific token that is burned each time the AI model is used. And that can be distributed partially to the AI researchers who created it, but also partially to those who contributed data. And so you have this kind of full economic system where data really is that currency.
This is really, really cool. One quick question about the... So it sounds like each DAO is different, and the mechanisms set by DAO members. What benefits do users gain by pooling data into a data DAO rather than selling individually?
Yeah, that's a really good question, right? So it's sort of like, hey, why don't I just go sell my Gmail and Instagram data myself, right? Why do I have to join a DAO? And I think also like DAO is almost this dirty word in crypto of like, DAOs generally have not worked that well, right? And like whenever you hear DAO, you're like, oh, is the team just like not involved? Are they just, I don't know. I think there's just a lot of skepticism. So the thing about data is like your data on its own is just not that valuable because it's not enough to train an AI model on, right? If you're an AI researcher, you need access to a pool of data. And within the sort of technical Vana architecture, we actually call these data DAOs data liquidity pools. And it's really about building that kind of data liquidity where data is sitting there available to use in bulk, because that's what gives people power, right? Combining data together. And so that's really the difference. But the risk of bringing all of our data together is that a malicious actor, like say the four of us, we like pool our Telegram messages. Like, I don't know, maybe Kenzie's like, okay, I'm going to like upload a bunch and then try to take control of the data set, right? And so what you need is like some way to ensure data coming in is actually high quality and to basically like value our data relative to each other. And so each data DAO implements that differently through proof of contribution. And that's what really ensures that the data quality is strong within each pool.
Got it. What has been the biggest challenge so far in the journey of Vana?
Yeah, I'm just thinking, like, I want to give like an honest answer. One is, I think that there's kind of this balance between building for the like long-term future that you see. And like, I mean, we currently exist in the present, right? So if you only build for the future you see 5 years out, like you may not see any adoption, right? And I think early on, like we patented non-custodial data in 2022 and people had like straight up no idea what that meant and could not care less, like at that time, where it was just like this abstract concept of like, oh, like, how does it work? Like it's kind of cool tech, but like nobody was using it. And so I think it's been this kind of constant tension between like, how do you build towards this like end vision of a user-owned data ecosystem where like users own their data, users can bring it, their data throughout applications and can own AI models that they train, and being quite tactical of like, okay, what product do we put in people's hands today? And I think that data, these like data liquidity pools, kind of data DAOs have really aligned those two things. But like, I mean, it took a long time, I think, for actually just the market generally to be ready for it, right? And I think in some aspects, it's about like the broader awareness of AI that's just like come into society recently, and the broader awareness too of the value of data, right? Like Reddit was basically like advertising the Reddit data DAO for the team by being like, hey, we're selling data for $200 million as like part of their IPO. But like no one knew that 2 years ago. Only people who worked like really closely in data sales, like my co-founder or some of our other team. And so, yeah, I think that balance has been hard. And I think if you experience that tension, it's kind of a good thing as a founder, because it means that you're like, you don't want to build for today. You want to build for like 3 to 5 years out, right? Or even further, to really like shift the world towards how you want it to be and how you think it's moving. But like, you must be tactical, right? And so you must like, how do you actually like get that going and get users and developers on board? We hosted a hackathon, I think, January 2023 at MIT, super early on. And it was like, we had the MIT Bitcoin Club co-hosting it, and then there was like this AI component. People were so skeptical. They were like, it's like a generative AI hackathon, but the MIT Bitcoin Club is involved. Like, how do crypto and AI work together, right? And there was like huge amount of skepticism. And now like on Friday, like giving a talk at MIT's Decentralized AI Summit, like obviously things have shifted. But yeah, it's painful to be early, but you also need to be early. So I think that has probably been the hardest thing.
Yeah, wow. That's such an amazing story. I can imagine how happy you are when ChatGPT came. You must be like, whoa, our moment is here.
Yeah.
Now it's our time.
Totally. Yeah. I shared like a Slack message I sent like summer of 2022 where it was like, hey, like I think these foundation models are finally getting good enough that people are going to start to kind of understand them and they're going to play a broader role in the economy. But yeah, and I think it comes to like down to having trust in yourself, having trust in the team of like, hey, like we believe the world is going to shift this way and we're going to kind of like keep pushing towards it. The other thing that's helped us a lot is actually data regulation, right? Of like, hey, like legally users own their data. And that is really important because like none of these big tech companies want users to take their data back. That like directly impacts their economics. And so that has also been a really strong wave to ride.
Well, that's great. You persevered. And perseverance is probably one of the number one qualities of any founder, you know, Web3 founders. But I also wanted to ask you, you know, since you've worked in both Web2 and also Web3, you dropped out to do, you know, YC company, and then you worked at Web3, you know, company, and then you started your own Web3 project. So you've done, you know, both rodeos, right? But they're also different. So wanted to ask you, what you see are some of the unique qualities of Web3 founders that it's different from Web2 founders that enable them to be successful in Web3.
Yeah, so Web3 is truly the Wild West, right? It's like still super, super early days, right? And everyone's figuring out what works. Even like dev co-structure, foundation structure, like it is super early on in terms of figuring everything out. And so I think that if you're building in Web3, you have to be ready for just like a huge amount of chaos. And often the thing that grounds you in that is like a very strong vision about the future and like very strong conviction of like, this is the way the world should move. So then you can basically like go through that like crazy turbulent world and be like, okay, we're still moving towards this. Like, this is what we're going towards. And I think that is especially true in Web3 just because of the pace of iteration and how quickly the industry moves. I'm just thinking about other like aspects that are important for Web3 specifically. I mean, I think that you have to have some level of like ideological belief that like we should have a user-owned internet, because largely crypto allows you to build tools that are more user-owned, right? And so you should have some strong belief related to like, this is how crypto is this enabling technology. Other things like specifically for Web3 founders. I mean, I think an understanding of like economics and a lot of the technical details as well, just because it's so early and we're still building as an industry a lot of the core infrastructure, like understanding how the technology works is important. So you can also understand how it might change, how things might evolve. Maybe one other thing is like, not getting sucked into herd mentality, which is extremely difficult, right? Like, especially like crypto Twitter as narratives shift, like it's all coming in. And so like, how do you maintain like your unique point of view? Because otherwise you just get like sucked into this mass and you're like, I don't know, just sort of like, I'm trying to think of a good analogy. It's kind of like you're just being blown by the wind rather than like actually pushing things forward. So, and that's hard, right? That's like super, super hard, especially in Web3, where there are all sorts of incentives to like pushing you to like, yeah, have some belief in some narrative. And I don't know how to find that within yourself exactly. I think it's like largely just trust in oneself and like some unique point of view, and then making sure that you're surrounded by the right people. So those are some of the attributes that I would mention. And enjoying crypto, right? Like, you have to actually like really believe in crypto. I mean, that maybe that's obvious, but like step, you're building in Web3. Yeah. You got to believe in crypto. Yeah.
Totally. Those are three incredible points. And yeah, it is tough. And honestly, now it's probably the last few months has been really tough because, you know, this market is not that great. And there's, you know, all these meme stuff going on. Yeah, it's tough now. Hopefully, you know, we'll come back.
I think it's a good, yeah, you know, I think like the more cycles you can go through as a founder or just someone building a crypto, the better, right? Like, I've been in crypto since 2015, so just like very unfazed. Yeah. You know, if you just zoom out enough, you're like, wow, this is amazing. Like, the presidential candidates are talking about crypto. Who would have thought that? Like, even, I don't know, 5-8 years ago. And so just like, I think zooming out and reminding ourselves like, hey, we've come really far, and like we might be it might feel rough right now, but as long as you zoom out enough, then there's a lot of optimism.
Or we're just in simulation.
I know. Well, then you could also take that to the extreme, and then just be like, well, like if we are in a sim, but that's maybe a whole rabbit hole.
What would you do differently if you had to restart your founder journey all over again?
I guess there are a few things I would keep the same. And like the number one thing I would keep the same is my co-founder. Like, I think that having an amazing co-founder is so important, and someone who you really like trust and kind of like Art and I are really good friends and just like rely on each other and have this like almost like foundational partnership that I think is really like at the root of everything that we've built. And so the number one thing I would not change is the co-founder. Like, that's like so important. I'm trying to think of other things. I mean, I think that early on, I would take advice from other people more. I were to go back, I would take less advice from other people. Like, I would listen to it and like use it as a data point. But the reality is, like, especially early on, when you haven't yet figured out how to communicate your vision and when people don't see what you're trying to build, which is also like where the value to be created is, like, it's very unlikely that other people can tell you what to do, right? And so I actually would have gone like the other direction of like kind of taking that advice, but then making sure I'm not weighting it too heavily, right? Like, weighted at like 10%. And so I think that's one big thing that I would do differently. But that's so hard, right? Like in retrospect, like I think especially as you're still forming as an entrepreneur, you want to like learn and take that advice. So I think it's valuable to take, but you have to be very, very cautious about not being kind of like overfit and like keeping to what you want to build. I think on the hiring side, I mean, every founder says this, right? But like finding people who are aligned with a mission is so important. And I think that it's really easy to compromise on that. You know, you're like, we need someone to do that. Like, we need someone to build this. Like, is this okay? But I think that in the long run, like you really need that dedication towards the mission and towards the vision and just alignment and like, hey, this is what we're trying to build. And just what else, like as a founder, if I were to restart, I would also prepare myself for immense suffering, right? But like, obviously, like, you know, it's coming and like no one thinks starting a company is hard, but like it is such a journey and it just takes so long. It takes so like just every week some fire. And so early on, I was like, I'm going to just like grind, push through nonstop. And I think I would have had a little bit more of like a, hey, this is really a marathon. Like, I feel like early on, I was like, I'm not even going to go to the dentist. Like, I don't even have time, or like random stuff like that. I would be like, no, like I'm building this company. And now I'm like, okay, Anna, like this thing takes several years. Like you can go to your physical, you know, like go do like basic human things. Because yeah, as a founder, it's just like going to be a journey.
I think Web3 is a little bit more chill than Web2. It's a little bit different. It's busier, but you also get to do a lot of stuff. Yes, it's a little bit different. Yeah, but yeah.
Like I remember when I was in YC once, I was like, you know, I think I'm doing too. Like I was coding while I was in Ubers, right? And I was like, you know, I think it's too stressful. Like I'm gonna make a rule where like when I'm in Ubers, I'm gonna like stop coding, right? And I'm like, okay, like actually, like is the marginal code I was writing in an Uber like making a difference? Like I don't know. And so I think like being able to zoom out and get some perspective is definitely important.
So shifting gears a bit here. So AI researchers are facing a data shortage. How does Vayna through data DAOs address this issue? And why is user-owned data essential in breaking through the data wall?
Yeah, great question. So today, if you look at how much data has been used to train leading models, so like Llama 3, it's around 15 trillion words. AI researchers will call it a token, but that's confusing for crypto people. So like 15 trillion words. And if you look at the whole public internet, so like basically you take everything that you can scrape from the internet without logging in, that's like the public internet, it's about 15 trillion words as well, right? So it's one, incredible that we have taken the entirety of the public internet and compressed it into an AI model that has learned. But then we have a problem, which is AI models, we want them to get better, right? But like, where are we going to get the data, right? So today, one way that people get data is by buying it from different companies, right? So like Reddit, they're earning like $200 million from selling their data. Apple's buying up a fair amount of data. Basically, if you have like user-generated content, you can probably get like $50 million for your data. But the problem there is that it actually, there's only some data that companies can sell. And so based on their terms of service, it actually limits what they're allowed to let people train on. So there are interesting cases, like my co-founder, when he was at Appen selling data to a big tech company, they were actually buying messaging data that sat in their servers, even though they had access to it. They couldn't legally train on it. So they were like, hey, go find me 10,000 people to export their messenger data and sell it back to me, right? And so there's actually this big data industry that most people are very unaware of that is largely bottlenecked by like users' willingness to contribute data. And the shift that Vayna really brings in is that it treats data as an asset, right? So rather than saying, hey, we're going to give you like $20 one-off for your data, it's more like, hey, you are going to get basically like equity in the data set, in the AI model that your data helps to create. And what we've seen is that from a user perspective, that is much more compelling because it's less like transactional. I think that selling your data can sort of almost feel like donating plasma or like selling your blood in this way where you're like, oh, I don't know. Whereas if it's about like getting to shape the future of AI, of like, hey, what should this AI model be allowed to talk about? Like, what is the appropriate censorship? Then it's kind of this broader like ownership rather than purely like a cash transaction. So yeah, with Vana, what we're doing is allowing people to pool their data through data DAOs. And the reason why the data DAOs are important is because your data on its own is not valuable, right? You need to pool it together and then use that to train leading AI models. So one of the models that's trained today is a model that's trained only on Reddit data, because it's just on Reddit data. It's only good at like shitposting, because that's what you learn from Reddit. But there are some models coming out. There's actually an AI research company looking at full pre-training. So that means you're not taking an existing model and fine-tuning it. You're actually training a model from scratch on data from three of the data DAOs. So that's going to be a really cool milestone I'm looking forward to. One other thing I'll mention is like, why have it be decentralized, right? Like, why can't you just have people pool their data in maybe a centralized company? And the reason for that is actually like data regulation, right? And so if we as a centralized company tried to go get people's Reddit data, we would pretty much immediately be shut down because we don't have the right to do that. And Reddit actually, like around when the Reddit data DAO hit 100,000 users, there was a Web2 reporter writing about it. They asked Reddit's PR team for a comment, and Reddit's PR team was like, "We're shut it. Like, they're violating the API terms. This is not allowed," and like trying to shut it down. But because it's decentralized, where like every user controls their data, we call it like non-custodial data, you can use data regulation to enforce, hey, legally every user has to be able to do that. And so that's kind of the decentralization piece that's really important, because no company that has a valuable data set has any desire for it to leave their walled garden, right? So you actually need this decentralization, both kind of from a financial perspective and kind of incentivizing it, but also just purely from a regulatory perspective of being able to use data regulation to make it work.
And you touched on this briefly, but what role does Vana's EVM-compatible blockchain play in facilitating the creation of data DAOs and incentivizing data pooling?
Yeah, good question. So basically data is more valuable if you can kind of like have it attributed across the same user, right? So for example, if I have my Spotify data and my fashion data, I can sell that for $25 to like a Fortune 500 fashion company who we work with. If I just have my Spotify data, that's only worth like 30 cents, right? So basically by having the data DAOs have data that's combined across multiple people and multiple data sources, the data gets like exponentially more valuable. So you want some kind of like chain that's acting as a source of truth for many different data DAOs. But then there's like we're an L1, which I think is counter to like today's Ethereum L2 narrative. And the reason for that is actually data regulation. So if you have a centralized sequencer that gets regulated as a data processor, which then under GDPR needs to give people the right to delete, which is very hard to do with any sort of blockchain. So you need aggressive decentralization of the nodes that basically keep state of people's data and their permissions and kind of the incentives that go along with it. So that's, yeah, like a little bit of history on Vana's EVM architecture. And it also allows for people to build DeFi applications with data as an asset, right? So like there's a DEX that lets people trade, this is all just on the testnet, between different data set specific tokens. And kind of there's this whole economy that can emerge around data as an asset class that lives on Vana's EVM-compatible L1.
So Vana is tapping into private data from social media platforms. Why would you say this data is more valuable than public internet data? And what makes Vana the right platform for monetizing it?
Yeah, so what makes it more valuable is that like if data is public, like why would someone pay money for something that's already public, right? Like just generally, and I think we've seen this actually play out in open source AI, where once you release model weights open source, it's very hard to monetize it, right? And so the reason why private data is valuable is because people don't have access to it today, so they're willing to pay for access to it, right? And that's what makes it really valuable. And it's actually especially valuable if it lives in these walled gardens of like social media giants, because currently they have a monopoly on it. Right? The only person who can sell Reddit data, for example, is Reddit. Like no one else can do that. But there's this other group, which is the users, right? And that's really what Vana is enabling. And our focus is really on just supporting all the different data DAOs who are building. We have an accelerator program of like 13 data DAOs right now. There are probably around 50 builders creating data DAOs, each focused on a specific data set and kind of bringing it out of wherever it lived and making it user-owned. So just whatever they need to succeed is what we have prioritized. And what that comes down to is like some way to store private data. Working with personal data is scary. So you want to make sure that it's very compliant from like a data regulation perspective. And then there are aspects too, which are related to like ensuring there's very good UX for people to connect their data, ensuring there's a way for people to train AI models and actually use that data. So those are, yeah, all the different pieces of the tech stack that I'd mentioned.
And can you go into more detail on how exactly Vana rewards or how users are able to monetize their data while also retaining ownership of their own data?
Yeah. So the way that it works when you connect your data, so say your Twitter data, like when I connect my, I'm trying to think of which example to use. Maybe I'll do 23andMe. So like when I connect, but I haven't used 23andMe, but as a 23andMe user, like I connect my 23andMe data and first I connect it just to Vana, the network, and I encrypt it with a key that I control. And then it lives in, we call it like a personal server, Urbit and Solid Project, two projects. They really pioneered this architecture and were like built on their shoulders of like, hey, users bring their storage and their compute environment. So you can connect your Google Drive, your Dropbox, and then you put an encrypted copy of your data there. That then allows you to like log into any application and use your data in that application, but just at the individual level. When you join a data DAO, what you're doing is kind of pooling your data together, right? So if the data DAO doesn't pay you upfront and just pays you in like a stable coin when the data is accessed, there are a few data DAOs doing this, then you can just keep your data in your personal storage. And only when they say, hey, someone's ready to buy your data, you decrypt your data, they get access to it in a secure environment, train a model, take the model weights out. Or if you want to get rewarded upfront, which is what the majority of the data DAOs do, then you encrypt your data with a key that the data DAO controls. And only if the data DAO votes is the data all kind of decrypted. It's basically holding the data in escrow. And what that allows for is kind of these collective actions that happen on the data set overall. And essentially what you're doing is like delegating the rights to manage your data for that specific data set to the DAO entity. And I think that this is maybe one thing I'd call out about DAOs generally, where often you have this problem of like early on, a lot of people participate and then everyone drops off and like 1% of people are voting. And yeah, you're like, oh, what do we do? But in the context of a data DAO, that's actually fine because like a whole bunch of people contributed their data and then a small number of people stick around and sort of make sure, hey, it's actually like governed in the right way. And in the future, I actually think there could be like legal data trusts who are almost like their role is to, yeah, facilitate the actions of the DAO that are economically rational. But I think that'll be further out. So yeah, that's one thing I'd mention on the data DAO structure side as well.
Yeah, I think personally, I'm very interested in this topic because that's why I got into crypto. And, you know, I've been studying it for a while. So I'm going to ask, like, I'm going to start with a question that's maybe like a little cynical. You know, in 2020, we saw a lot of projects in this space, a lot of data unions, data pools, and there were like a lot of research on data trusts, etc. Why do you think that these so many, you know, smaller projects that came out or bigger projects that started research in this area have sort of not picked up the way that we would have wanted it to, because they came with such like ethical white papers and there was so much promise? But why is it that nobody could succeed at data monetization or giving users the kind of rewards they actually need?
Yeah. So I'd say it's like two things. One is really just like AI has raised the stakes for data ownership, right? Where previously, like if you owned your data, the main thing you could do with it is bring it to different applications. And then mostly like 4 years ago, 5 years ago, you were just using data for like personalized marketing, right? So if I have access to your data, the only person I can really only like serve, use it to serve you ads to monetize it, right? Whereas if you're using it to train an AI model, then you can pool people's data. It can be anonymized. doesn't really matter who it came from. And so you have a lot more kind of fungibility of data. So the number one thing I would say is just that AI has really, really raised the stakes in terms of like value of data. And you're seeing this materialize in the form of like OpenAI hit $3.4 billion in revenue, right? Like you basically like these AI models are super valuable and they're largely just like created from data. The second thing I would mention is that I think that early on, like Ocean Protocol and other projects, they took this approach of actually going to businesses and they would say, hey, like you should put your data on chain and allow users to and allow people to access your data as a business, right? And the reality is, like, if you're a business who wants to sell their data, like, putting it on chain is not unlocking that much for you, right? Whereas in the context of Vana, where, like, you're realizing you own your data as a user and you didn't even realize it, right? It's, like, much more zero to one. It's much more of a step function in terms of what it unlocks. Those are the two major reasons I would mention. Maybe the third aspect I would say is that a lot of people building in the space have believed that ideology is all you need to like get things adopted. And it just hasn't worked. Like think of the last product you've used for ideological reasons. Like I'm super ideological and like I barely use, that's not why I use a product. I use a product because I want to do something I couldn't do before. And so I think a part of it too is that the industry or the folks building towards data ownership kind of got stuck in this like ideological like echo chamber and I think weren't tactical enough of like, hey, like how do we actually get people bringing data in? And so that's the other side point I'd mentioned. But I think that everyone building in the space early on, like I'm super grateful to just because it's an undertaking, right? And like we've gotten to build on like solid projects, shoulders and other protocols. And so I'm like rooting for everyone because I think it's this really tough space to solve.
Yeah, I think we really all wanted to succeed, you know, like because that's like such a basic ethos of like the whole blockchain industry. I've never understood one thing. What's the difference between a data DAO, a data trust, and a data union? And which is the most ideal model to follow?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I think that there's, honestly, it's still pretty early. So I think the definitions are still kind of getting defined. Data trust is a word that is, I think, referring to like a legal entity that there's actually a researcher, Sylvie Delacroix, who, if you've read some of her work, she's really like the leader in these data trusts. And so it is a legal entity that's designed to allow people to kind of pool their data together. A data DAO is the on-chain version of that. It can actually be mapped to a data trust in the legal world and then live on-chain as a data DAO. And I think a data union is maybe like a slightly more general form of both of those, more like informal. I think that actually like a labor union for data kind of describes all three. I've also gotten to learn from like some of the union leaders at like the UCs on like, hey, how do they actually like negotiate? What have they found to work well for labor unions? And then bringing that towards the data DAOs and the data unions on Vana as well.
Yeah. Another good researcher is Anouk Ruhak from Mozilla for data trust. So even her work is like very good. Okay. Awesome. I want to be like on. Sure. I want to be conscious of the time as well. Just one more question and then we go to rapid fire. So what is it that you learned actually from the success of Reddit Data DAO? And how will you implement the learnings into, say, you are also doing the LinkedIn, the Twitter Data DAO already, right?
Yeah, there's a Twitter Data DAO. Yeah. There's a LinkedIn Data DAO. There are over like 200 Data DAOs on the testnet, a whole bunch of them.
Okay.
I think that I would say the Reddit Data DAO was like 10x, if not 100x, more successful than anyone was expecting it to be. Like, yeah. In a week, there were like 140,000 real Reddit users who joined. It was close to 1 million people overall, but only 140,000 people passed proof of contribution, which is just insane. As a crypto product, like that is really impressive. And I think we were all like, whoa, like that's kind of great. Like we were all honestly genuinely surprised. And there was a really cool dynamic where like, early on, it was kind of just the crypto people who came in. I mean, you had this like Reddit data set specific token and they were sort of, interacting with and trading that data set specific token, which the Reddit data DAO actually didn't expect at all. They were like, please, they like put messages up that were like, please don't trade this token. It's like just for governance. And that like did not work at all. But then that led everyday Reddit users who had a lot of karma to come in because they could get $300 or $400 for their data. So there were a lot of like users who were totally new to crypto who came in and got involved. And so I think like what it taught us is, one, there's like a huge appetite for users to actually get involved with these data DAOs, user-owned data sorts of applications. The other thing I'd say is it brought in like, I think the majority of people building a data DAO on Vana today heard about us through the Reddit data DAO. And they were like, hey, I want to do this for Twitter data, or I want to do this for LinkedIn data. And I think that's actually a really good learning for just like founders and projects of like, hey, if you want to like enable builders, like actually partner closely with builders and go through the act of starting something yourself to understand it and show how big of a success it can be. And then allow others to sort of like, almost bootstrap off of that and allow it to continue. So that's the major learning I would flag. Honestly, I didn't expect Reddit to like try to shut it down so soon, right? So I actually was kind of surprised at how quickly they got involved from the perspective of checking, hey, is this allowed? But that really actually shows the value of Vana being decentralized, right? Where you need every user directly managing their data. So it's supported by data regulation. That's the other thing I'd mention.
Yeah, I think it's really cool you have so many applications, and I can really keep talking, but we should get to the wrapper.
Yeah, it brings me so much joy, honestly. I wish I could like clone myself and start every data DAO. Like I'm straight up jealous of every builder. I'm like, I wish I could make that one. And then I'm like, oh, the Aura one, like, oh, I wish I, yeah, but that's like good because then you enable people to build really cool applications.
Yeah, that's really cool. Okay, so we have a few minutes and let's do a rapid fire. It's like a mix of personal and professional questions. We try to get a little on the lighter side of the podcast with this. Ready, Anna?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So what's the one word that you would use to describe Vana?
User-owned data.
Okay, give it another try with something, what it means for you.
What it means for me? Mm-hmm. It's maybe like a journey, like or something. Yeah. Mission, journey. Mm-hmm.
That's nice. Who has been the most influential person in your professional life and why?
My co-founder, because we've gotten to build Vana together and it's been so much fun and we've gotten to like shape each other along the way. So my co-founder, Art.
What's the one thing that people misunderstand about data ownership?
I think people often just see the financial use cases, but I actually think the bargaining use cases are very powerful. Like Reddit actually enabled, they changed their terms of service, allowing researchers access to data following the Reddit data DAO. And the 23andMe DAO is advocating for changes in their terms of service as well, where they want people, 23andMe, to fully delete data. So I think... the bargaining power that comes with data.
Who has been the most difficult hire for Vana and why?
There was a period of time where I think we had, we were growing a lot as a company and we hired, I would say, like people who fall in this category of like very professional managers. And I think that even as you're growing as a startup, that's often not necessarily what you need. And so I think like, bringing people in who are maybe not quite ready for that startup environment and just thrive better in another environment that's maybe more formal, more like traditional managerial, leading a massive team. And so, I think one hiring mistake is thinking that, oh, like this person led a massive team, that means they're great. And it's like, that's actually entirely uncorrelated. Maybe it's negatively correlated, actually. Yeah.
Well, you need hands-on people. In the beginning.
Yeah. You know, I'm like, hey, I'm pushing code out here. Like, what are you? So I think it's just important people are ready to get involved.
Cool. What's like that one book you read, or it could be a podcast, or it could be anything. It could be even be a movie that, left a very good message and you always, you remember it fondly.
Yeah, Tyler Cohen, who's an economist, has this blog called Marginal Revolution that I've been reading for like a very long time now. I read it pretty much every day and it's just like an interesting economic lens on the world. And so that I think has shaped, some of my economic thinking.
Cool. And last, our last question on this podcast is that what is your advice to 10 years younger Anna?
Okay, 10 years younger Anna is actually still in high school. No, I'll give her advice.
Okay.
I think it would just be like to be just like continue the ambition, like be as like actually encouraging her to be even more ambitious earlier on. Just like go after whatever you want. Like be like truly like just yeah, make don't feel like you need to like constrain the ambitions for practical reasons. Just be as ambitious as you want. And then surround yourself with the right people who kind of see that vision to the extent possible. And be very, very persistent in like exactly what you want. Like be very uncompromising in the vision that you're going after. Just thinking if there's anything else I would tell her. No, I just feel like keep believing in yourself. Like life's going to be great. Just hype her up for the next 10 years to come. She'd be like, yeah.
And also you'll be proud of yourself after 10 years. So keep going.
Oh, yeah, of course. But like, I think I'm trying to think of like what the diff I would want to tell myself is. Like what is like some info that I might not be capturing?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, that's very sweet and positive. So thanks, Anna. We had so much fun. We could have kept asking you so many questions, especially me. I was truly excited for this episode. And thanks to Sachi and Kenzie for making this happen, co-hosting, asking the questions to you for your time. And Steve, our editor, who makes these recordings nicer. And thanks everyone for listening. So see you next time.
Great. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you.